Welcome to Homeschool Companion, your source for information, motivation, and inspiration. If you're part of the homeschool community or simply interested in learning more about home-based education, stay tuned. Together, we'll examine the latest resources, learning styles, and teaching techniques. We'll speak with experts in the field to help you uncover every homeschool advantage. We'll also present suggestions on how to keep Christ in the curriculum as we explore fresh ways to teach and learn. Here's your Homeschool Companion host, author, educator, and children's ministry specialist, Dr. Rose Gamblin.
Welcome, welcome. I'm Dr. Rose Gamblin, and today we're going to talk with Bill Federer, and he has been so passionate about history. You were raised in St. Louis, the fifth of 11 children, and Bill has lettered in wrestling, football, and was a state finalist in track and high hurdles. He graduated from St. Louis University High School, studied at the University of Dallas, Texas, in Rome, Italy, and graduated from St. Louis University with a degree in accounting, business, and administration. Then, of course, how did you get so passionate about history?
Well, you're kind of a whole lot of the early part of my life in that we were helping with different churches and teaching some Bible classes back in the late 1980s. And then I began to collect quotes from founding fathers, like a lot of people did. And this is before the days of computers, so we would go to the library and check out all these books printed in the 1700s, 1800s, and I began to compile them. Finally printed a book in 1994, and it went on to sell 500,000 copies. It's called America's God and Country Encyclopedia Quotations. Focus on the Family sold several hundred thousand copies of it, and then this opened the door to be on lots of radio and television and do literally thousands of interviews. And over the last 20-some-odd years, I've written about 30 different books on popular topics. One on Islam. I go through the whole history of how Muhammad went from being a religious leader to a political leader to a military leader, and he personally fought in 66 battles and raids. And since he's the perfect Muslim, there are some that want to follow his example. I did a book on faith of George Washington Carver, the African-American scientist that developed uses for the peanut. Did one on the faith of FDR. He was a liberal back then, but he passed out Gideon's New Testaments and Book of Psalms to all the soldiers in World War II, right? I got a copy. He says, as commander-in-chief, I take pleasure in committing the reading of the Bible. Yes. Anyway, I began to compile a lot of these quotes and started to see how unique America was. These different people, like Daniel Webster, and he says, miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world. So here's somebody thinking, number one, he's mentioned in 6,000 years of recorded history, and then he's talking about how unique America is. And so this sparked the next several years where I decided to research every civilization that's ever existed on the planet. And I literally went back to the beginning of recorded human history, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Today that's Iraq. 3300 BC is when secular history books say writing was invented. And so if you think of it, 3 or 4,000 BC, and we're around 2,000 AD, 4-2, that's around 5 or 6,000 years of recorded history. Even FDR said, 5,000 years of recorded history has proven that mankind has always believed in God in spite of the many abortive attempts to exile God. But he's mentioning 5,000 years. If you think of it, let's say 6,000 years, right? That's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. So how many of you, you know, how many people you've met someone who's lived 100 years? Maybe a grandmother.
Yeah.
Right? So we're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history.
That's amazing.
It's not that long ago, 60 people living 100 years each back to back. And the question is, well, what's the most common form of government? Is America really that unique? Let's look at it. You read the history records, and you'll read the stories of pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaisers and Khans and Caesars and Emperors and Indian Maharajas and Aztec Montezumas and King Kamehamehas. And you're reading the stories of kings. Lo and behold, king is the most common form of government in world history. So people say, well, we don't have kings now. Well, yeah, they're called communist dictators, right? So every communist country has a dictator, Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro. And then the Communist Party members are the new royalty. They get to live in the nice houses. And then the people are the peasants, right? And so we still have it today that power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. It's like gravity pulling a satellite back down to the earth. It's just there. And I think it goes back to the fall in the garden and Cain killing Abel and selfishness coming into the human DNA. So you put some babies in a playpen, one of them will take the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. You put some people in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some people in the inner city, one of them is the gang leader. It just sort of happens because it's in like the Lord of the Rings, where there's a line where Gandalf tells Frodo, always remember, Frodo, the ring is trying to get back to its master. It wants to be found. Power wants to concentrate. And we look at this history, and we see it's sort of what they call a Fibonacci sequence, but it's a proportionate circle that increases geometrically. So like a nautilus shell or water going down a drain or a tornado or a galaxy. It's this spiral. It starts real small, but then it keeps getting bigger until it gets real big. And so you see that out of that selfishness, when Adam and Eve sinned, Cain kills Abel. And then you have Nimrod in the Tower of Babel. Now, the Jewish commentary says Nimrod wanted to build the tower so high that if God destroyed the world again with a flood, Nimrod could survive on top. So it sort of had this defiant, in-your-face attitude. God comes down, confuses the languages, and they scatter. So we see this first illustration of concentrated power, defiant against God, and scattered power, right? And so it's like every generation wants to rebuild the Tower of Babel, and they get another person who wants to be the new Nimrod. So you have 2,000 years and 33 major Egyptian dynasties ruled by pharaohs who own the people, the cattle, the land. You have 5,000 years, 18 major Chinese dynasties ruled by emperors, Indian maharajas, right? Raja means king, maha means great, and they claim to be semi-divine.
Yeah.
You had Aztec Montezumas and King Kamehamehas, but the kingdoms keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger until finally the king of England had the biggest empire that planet Earth had ever seen. Now, clearly there's a global goal in mind, but at the founding of our country, it was the king of England. And when America's founders got the chance, they wanted to set up a government that was as far away from a king as possible. They flipped it and made the people the king. So a republic is the people are king, ruling through their representatives.
Now, your latest book, Who is the King of America? Is yes. that the title?
Who is the King in America?
You don't want us to know?
No,
you want us to go to your
you
website? Yeah, you got to buy the book.
It's fascinating in the book. America's founders broke away from the king of England, and they wanted to set up a government as far away from a king as possible, so they flip it and make the people the king. So America is a republic, right? We pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic for which it stands. A republic is the people are king ruling through their representatives.
Yes.
A democracy is the people are king ruling directly themselves. So a democracy only ever worked on a citywide level where everybody is there every day. Once it grew larger than a city and you couldn't be there, the whole thing falls apart. You had to trust somebody else to tell you what's going on, and they can twist it one way or the other. So a republic can grow larger because you take care of your family and farm, and you have someone in your place that goes to the market and talks politics every day. They are your res publica. You're in the place of, right?
Yeah.
So America is a republic. And the interesting thing I found, reading through the founding fathers, where did they get this idea that people could rule themselves without a king? Well, they did get some from the Roman Republic until Julius Caesar found a way to usurp power and make himself dictator for life. They did get some ideas from the Athenian democracy until Philip of Macedon, he was the father of Alexander the Great, he found out that he could bribe citizens of Athens with money under the table and they would betray their own city. Wow. Yeah. And so Athens fell. But America's founders ultimately look back to ancient Israel. And you think, ancient Israel? Yeah, ancient Israel was the first instance of an entire nation ruled without a king. So we see about 1400 BC is when Israel comes out of Egypt. And the Pharaoh controls everything in Egypt. When Israel comes into the Promised Land, for those first 400 years in the Promised Land, there's no king. Everyone is equal before the law. And the law says there's no respect of persons in judgment. So this is interesting. Wherever there's a king, if you're friends with the king, you're more equal. If you're not friends with the king, you're less equal. And if you are an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. Or you're a slave. And so there's this hierarchical structure to society that repeats itself all over the globe for 60 centuries. When ancient Israel comes into the Promised Land, they're under the law. The law specifically says there is no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone is to be treated the same. Male, female, made in the image of the Creator. Even the stranger living amongst you is under the same law that you're under. You compare this to the Islamic Sharia law, where the stranger non-Muslim has no rights compared to a Muslim male. In Israel, everyone was equal before the law. literally, this is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth. That Amen. Everyone you see is equal to you. There's no royal family to butter up next to. And then it gets more interesting how Israel is unique. Israel is the first nation with private land ownership. You see, wherever there's a king, you never really own the land. It is always conditional of you staying on the nice side of the king. Right? You do what he says, he gives you some land. You don't do what he says, he takes away the land and kills you. In Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. If they got in a pinch and sold it every 50 years, it reverted back to the family. This prevented a dictator from gathering up the land and putting the people back into slavery, right? And so if you own land, you can accumulate stuff. The Bible called that being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist, right? You got stuff, you worked hard and saved it. So ancient Israel is unique because everybody's equal. It's unique because everybody owns private land. Israel is the first nation with no standing army. You have a king. He has an army to enforce his will. In ancient Israel, every man was in the militia and armed and ready at a moment's notice to defend his family and his community, right? Ancient Israel is unique in that it's the first nation with no police. Everyone was taught the law. Everyone enforced the law. It's like everybody was deputized. Ancient Israel was unique in that it's the first nation with a bureaucracy-free welfare system. In Israel, when somebody harvested their land, they left the gleanings for the poor people to pick through. So in Israel, the poor were taken care of, like Ruth, you know?
Yeah.
But it didn't have some political leader collecting everything and doling it back out to those who can help them stay in power. Ancient Israel is unique in that it was one where everyone could read. Now, I thought this was the most fascinating thing in all my research. At the time that Moses went into the Promised Land, that Mesopotamia, they had 1,500 cuneiform characters. I don't know about you, but memorizing 1,500 anythings, how'd you like to write with 1,500 characters? And it was only for kings and scribes. The common people didn't read and they didn't write, right? So writing was invented originally as an accounting method to keep track of all the stuff the king owned, right? So the first invention ever was the plow. Cain was a tiller of the soil. Then people started hitting each other with it, turned into weapons. People gravitated together for protection. And when people come together, somebody knows how to fight better than the rest and say, you be our captain. And he saves everyone. And then afterwards, he has kids and grandkids who claim to be an elite class. My granddad's the one we're all indebted to. And so my family, and so it turns into a hereditary monarchy. And the king claims to own everything and wants accountants to count it. So in China, the emperors had scribes that came up with a way of counting with knots and ropes. They tie all these little knots, these ropes. That's how they would count. And so in Sumeria, they invented an abacus with rods and beads. You slide mm-hmm. back and forth. And then they invented tokens in dishes. You got a warehouse. How much stuff is in the warehouse? Well, let's see. There's a little dish in front with little tokens. And then they started making markings in the tokens. Like you're tallying and you draw the lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then a line across for 5. That was the beginning of writing, an accounting method for the kings to keep track of all their stuff. In Sumeria, they had 1,500 of these little markings. In Egypt, they had 3,000 hieroglyphic markings, characters. Again, only for the pharaohs and the scribes. And the scribes kept the writing secret. It was their secret knowledge. They kept it complicated on purpose as job security. So when Moses came down the mountain, he did not just have the law. He had the law in a 22-character alphabet. So easy to learn. Children could learn how to read. Ancient Israel is the first instance where a nation, everyone could read.
Wow.
So we see not only is Israel unique in that it's the first nation without a king, it's the first nation with private land ownership, everybody owns a weapon, everybody is enforcing the law, and everybody could read.
Wow, as you're talking, we've come so far in our own country. Connecting the dots, you're saying that our republic, our constitution, as they set up the government, a biblical worldview, and they base this lovely idea of the people being the king. Now today, in 2017, who is the king in America?
Well, John Jay was the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He says the people are the sovereign of this country. Thomas Jefferson says the Supreme Court justice says there must be an ultimate arbiter or decider somewhere. True, there must. The ultimate arbiter is the people. Abraham Lincoln said, the people are the rightful masters of both Congresses and courts. Governor Morris, who signed the Constitution, says the magistrate is not the king. The people are the king. So in America, The people are the king, you and I. And so imagine visiting a king, maybe in the Old Testament. You're going through the streets of Jerusalem, and you're witnessing murder and rape and crime, and you get into the king's chamber. And he has his head in his hand, looks all worried, and he looks at you, and he says, did you see all that crime coming in here? I wish somebody would fix it. You, like, reach over, tap him on the shoulder, say, excuse me, you're the king. This is your kingdom. You're the one accountable to God to fix it. That's like somebody in America listening to the radio or watching TV and hearing about all the terrible stuff going on and saying, I wish somebody would fix it. Hello, reach through the TV tube and through the radio speaker and tap you on the shoulder. You are the king. You're the one accountable to God to fix this mess. Well, I need somebody to tell me what to do. Since when does the king sit on his throne and say, can somebody tell me what I'm supposed to do here? Hey, butler, come here. What am I supposed to do? No. You take the time, you hear from God, and you tell your servants what to do. And so the politicians are your public servants. You hire a plumber, a trash collector, and a politician. They're to carry out your will. Mm-hmm. And so Romans 13, every authority is set up by God. God allowed our founders to set it up so the people are the ultimate authority in America. And they say, wake up. You don't just have the right to vote in America. You're going to be held accountable to God for what happens in America. You are the king.
Now that brings to mind, the Laodicean church as told in the Bible where, you know, we're neither hot nor cold. We're all asleep.
Right. And so you look back in history at the example of ancient Israel, and when they served God, they were blessed. When they didn't serve God, God let them get overrun. And so Deuteronomy 28 says, these are the blessings if a nation hearkens to the voice of the Lord. They'll be above and not beneath, head and not the tail, a lender and not a borrower. And then it says, these are the curses if a nation does not hearken to the voice of the Lord. They'll be a debtor, and the stranger amongst them will rise up and be their ruler.
That's scary.
Well, in the last 40 years, America has gone from the largest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation. We're on the judgment side of the page. And then the stranger amongst them will rise up and be their ruler. God judges a nation by having strangers come in and rising up and ruling over the inhabitants. And so in Israel's case, the Philistines came in. And the Amalekites and the Amorites and the Hittites, they all came in and they began to oppress the people of Israel. Now, when they repented, God rose up a deliverer, Joshua, Gideon, Samson, Jephthah, right? And they returned back to the Lord. And so it's important to understand God is interested in every single individual person turning back to him personally. And that is what a nation is. A nation is nothing more than a collection of individuals.
So I don't know really how to word it, but it seems like in history, when threats come, the people do tend to look for a king. There's just that, you know, they get scared. And so do you think we're in that kind of situation in the United States where it's either being orchestrated that we have threats? You know, it's either a perception or it's a reality that we are now being threatened by terrorism, let's say. Do you think in a way that's being orchestrated so that the power can get into the hands of a few?
Right. I feel like we've had a miraculous reprieve. But the agenda that has been at work for 8 years, and actually a lot longer than that, has been this intentional creating or capitalizing on a crisis to consolidate control.
Okay.
And so let's look back at ancient Israel. The priests had the responsibility of teaching this system to the people. The priests stopped doing it, and it fell apart. And so if you look at it, every generation of Israelites was responsible to serve the Lord, and it was the priest's job to teach him it. And when the priest stopped teaching the law, here's Eli, the main guy supposed to be teaching it. His own sons are sleeping with women in the tent of meeting with the Lord.
Yes.
Another Levite with a graven image in the house of a guy named Micah, the tribe of Dan, comes along, takes this silver graven image, take this priest, and they say, you can be a priest for our whole tribe. And you're scratching your head thinking, what's this Levite doing with a graven image? Isn't that one of the laws you're not supposed to have? So that the Levites were no longer teaching the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see this pattern that in times of domestic crises, the rubber band snaps back. Now that's Israel. We look at Athens about 500 years later, and Plato says, I got it in all my book, but he says, democracy without virtue always ends in chaos, out of which a tyrant arises. We look at ancient Rome. It was a republic until Julius Caesar found a way to usurp power, make himself dictator for life. But then we look at Italy 500 years ago. They had city-states. Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, and they always fought. A guy named Machiavelli said, you know what, if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop this infighting. He writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end, any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So, if a prince conquers a city, they would hate him. But if the prince pays criminals to kill cows and burn barns and create domestic crises and terror, the people will cry out for help. The prince will come in, kill the very criminals he bribed. Nobody would know the better for it, and they'd all praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire. Then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher. They'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. Now, that influenced somebody named Hegel. Now, what's this? Napoleon conquers Germany and Prussia real easy. So afterwards, the king of Prussia says, we got to strengthen our state. So he gets a philosopher named Hegel, who says, oh, the state is God walking on earth. And he comes up with a way to concentrate power called Hegelian dialectics. Sounds complicated, but it's not. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis, the opposite is an antithesis, and the top corner of the triangle is a synthesis. So you start off at square one, the first corner, then you create the opposite. You create an antithesis, you create a crisis. And once the crisis is really bad, everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And Marx, Karl Marx applied this to politics. Says, well, how do you create a crisis that's real bad? You send in agitators, agent provocateurs, provoking agents. You send in community organizers, labor organizers. Their job is to find the fault lines, the tension lines, the grievances in society and stir people up to riot.
Yeah.
And once the rioting and bloodshed gets really bad, everybody is willing to surrender their freedoms to some dictator that promises to fix it. And when the dust settles, you'll just have fundamentally transformed your country from the people ruling back to some king. Right. So it concentrates power. And so it works best if the people are not Christian. Even Napoleon said religion is what keeps the poor from murdering the rich. So if you have Christian people, the agitators can't get, the Christians will just forgive.
Yeah.
But if you get rid of Christianity, then you got raw human passion. You've been wronged. You want what they have. Yeah. Follow me. You'll get it. You stir them up. And so Karl Marx would organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. Would organize the blacks against the whites, the Muslims against the Christians, the Catholics against the Protestants, the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo and Rwanda. They really don't care who the two sides are. Their goal is a destabilizing crisis with random bloodshed in the street that's so bad everybody will surrender their freedoms to some person that promises to fix it.
Wow.
So the politics we've been experiencing in America has been the intentional creating or capitalizing on a crisis so that you can have some leader promising to fix it, and in the process, take away the rights and the freedoms of the people.
Wow, what a note to end on. We're talking with Bill Fader, and he wrote the book, Who is the King in America? There's many more books that you've written that we could talk about, and I encourage everyone to go to your website, refresh my memory again on it.
It is AmericanMinute.com. I send out a free daily email called American Minute that anyone can sign up for.
So you can sign up for that email, and I hope this is a call to each one of you as to your responsibilities as King of America. We'll have one last thing to say, and that is God bless.
You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.